All right, so just give you an outline of what's going to happen today. First thing we're going to do is debrief from the individual contest. So we'll talk about that in just a second. Then we're going to walk through a few extra steps on the MicroPython programming, primarily addressing how to use the little servo motor, hobby-style servo motor that you bought as part of your kit, how to accept user input into your script, which can be really useful for testing purposes. To read input from the REPL, or from the serial prompt, actually. And then we are going to distribute final project kits once we get that up. So what we're going to do is walk through the servo, how to use servo, how to use input, have a couple of examples posted up you can be working on, and then while you're working on those examples, we're going to distribute the final project kits to you. Okay, so that'll kind of take place the second half of class today. You have time to work on a couple in-class examples that we'll see today, and then you'll get the kit for the final project that's yours. Okay. That kind of sound okay for the schedule? Okay. So first of that was debriefing from the individual contest. It's been a couple days now. What did you learn from that contest? Yes, sir.
How fast the time goes by.
It goes by pretty quickly. So yeah, that time goes by quickly. So what does that mean? How does that influence your design?
I'm trying to make it really easy to set up.
Really easy to set up, right? So if you feel that kind of compression of time, one way to alleviate that is to make the boxing and setup really easy, right? So we've talked about you have some demands on your device volume, right? But if you build right to the edge of that volume, getting that box on and off is going to be kind of hard. And extend your setup time. So like I recommend from day one when we talked about this, you have some demands on those dimensions. You probably now, especially now, you know more about this problem. You know way more about this problem now than you did when you wrote your problem understanding report, right? So that changes the weights in that house of quality matrix, which then propagates all the way through to the spec sheet. Okay, I have wants or wishes that I'm not 24 inches, I'm 20 inches long. And I'm not 12 inches wide, I'm 10 inches wide. And I'm 16 inches tall instead of 18. What else? What do you mean by that?
Like figuring out like distances between things and how you think you have time to do something, but you realize it's a lot closer, like the distances are a lot closer.
Sure. So kind of trying to understand the placement of components on the track, the timing of how to get to those places. And that comes with being coming to look at the lab, being in open hours, moving forward, right? What you build in your garage or whatever is going to be a little bit different than what we have here, right? So I think it's important, even if you do have a full shop at home and build a replica of the track, to at least come in and test on this track sometimes. See that? Yes, sir.
Being as simplistic as possible.
Sure. So. Yeah, I think that a simple design is good. I think the danger of having that being your team's mantra, and I see this a lot in senior design projects, we want this to be simple as possible, and then you ignore 3/4 of that functionality that was actually asked of you. Right? Well, that's not a simple design. That's a failure as a design because you're not doing all the things that are required your customer's asking of you. So the part of be as simple as possible that most people tend to forget is be as simple as possible, but no simpler. Right? So I'm all for being as simple as possible, but remember that you still have customer requirements that you need to satisfy. Right? Yeah.
Nothing is perfect.
Nothing is perfect. That is true. Right.
Operations.
So I'm going to highly recommend you'll hear me throughout the rest of the semester. Like you have a team competition coming up in a little bit, right? You shouldn't be boxing your design for the first time on competition day as a team. Okay, I'm going to recommend as you go along, that probably even rolling into the final contest, and maybe even for the preliminary or qualifying, that you have an actual checklist that you run down. Right? And if someone's going to forget to plug a wire in or turn their code in or push a button like they're supposed to set up their code or whatever. Okay, don't let that ruin a bunch of work for you. Do worse than you could have. There's a reason why pilots still have kind of physical checklists, right? That works. Nothing's perfect. I think you also the track is certainly not perfect as well, right? So your device is not going to work perfectly. The track's not going to work perfectly. So the sensors we've been learning about can help you mitigate some of that, right? If you rely on timing, the timing on the red zone might be a little bit different than the timing on the black, right? Whereas if you're using the sensors to sense distance and using that, you're able to measure the environment and react to that rather than trying to do what we call open loop control. Open loop control, when you get to 474, basically I'm trying to control a system without sensing anything about my environment. Right? Closed loop, I measure the environment and it loops back in and informs what I should be doing. Right? So you can have a very simple closed loop feedback controller effectively on your system. We'll try to time how long it gets to the middle, sense when you actually get there. Okay. What else? Anything else? Yes, sir.
Instead of to like overdo it and underdo it, so like in this contest I just did, like, better to have the robot like hit the cones harder than like just enough, because it might not work. It might not, the cones might not fall off.
Sure, I think that falls a little bit into things are not going to work perfectly. Right. So if you design it such that everything has to work perfectly for the cones to just get out just a millimeter, things are not going to work perfectly. They're likely to be inside. Right. That's right. I think the danger of that way of thinking, I had a conversation with one of my senior design teams the other day about this. Oh, they wanted to use half-inch bolts instead of a quarter. I'm like, why? Well, we just want it to be stronger. Okay, well, the quarter was way more stronger than they even needed, actually, if you sat down and did even the back of the envelope calculations. So you need some margin for error, some safety factor, but there is a limit to what's reasonable for those applications. Right? You just still have to stay functional within your application domain. Right. Anything else? Any questions about how things went, how things are going to go for the contest moving forward? Yes, sir. How many times can you run in the 5 minutes?
Three times.
So what will happen for the preliminary contest, right? You can tell us to stop it early, but you have to tell us that. Okay. If you don't tell us that, it's going to run for the whole 30 seconds. Okay. And then if your device keeps running after that 30 seconds and moving, then you get disqualified, right? So you can tell us to stop it early, and provided everything has stopped, you can't tell us to stop it while things are still moving, right? So provided it's reached a static condition, equilibrium condition, you can say, okay, that's it. That's all it's going to do. We'll stop it early, count the points, you can set up again. So that's a pretty good strategy for this next concert in order to help you get the three runs in. And the timing will work a lot like the contest this week, right? Your time will start. When that timer starts, that's when your team can set your device down, plug everything in, get set up, box it, move it as a rigid body, and then away we go. If you get back to the same size about, we won't make you box it again, but we reserve the right to ask you to box it if things don't get back to the same size. Yes, sir? Got it. Yes?
How are we going to be scored? It says you'll have 5 minutes to run the machine at most three times. The score will be the sum of the three attempts. Are we getting graded out of three?
There's a separate section in the PDF about how the grade's calculated. There's a whole kind of subsection about grading from each contest that's broken out from the contest rules. Other questions? Yes?
You mentioned 30 seconds. Will it be 30-second runs? And we'll have 5 minutes to set things up? And
you have 5 minutes to run three times, including the run time. Yeah. So that's where if your device only runs for 2 seconds, you can tell us to stop it. Yeah. Has to be triggered from the track this time, right? So track downstairs, we'll talk through in a lot more detail about that on Tuesday. It's just like reading a push button. It's electrically identical to reading your push button, actually. So effectively what our button does for each side of the track that you plug into, when we push our button, it closes a relay and holds it closed for 30 seconds. At the end of that 30 seconds, it opens it, which is, again, electrically equivalent to you holding a push button down for 30 seconds. It's how the start button works. So you have to sit there, wait for that button to be pushed. And when it's pushed, you can start going. But then it's our button and not yours. And again, we'll talk a lot more detail on Tuesday about that. Other questions? Yes, sir.
For the report, the next one, it says just briefly go over the problem understanding. So that means we don't have to actually put like the house of quality or.
So the question is, I think, do we still need to include the design tools in the next report? Yes, I think so. Because without those tools there, your reader is not going to be able to follow your evaluation of those concepts. Well, I think you have the same page limit, right? So if you were up against the limit in the first report, you're going to need to be more concise in this one on the problem understanding. Right? But your reader still does need that information in order to understand why your concept's a good one and why the ones that are not selected are not quite as good. Right. Yes, sir?
Can we get the problem understanding grade
back? We sure will. But you also have your Arliss reports. And you have three Arliss reports within your team that have the, kind of the same, shake out to be a, kind of the same report, like the same style report. Any other questions?
On the conceptual design, do we have to have the nuts and bolts of it? Or just
conceptual design. So like Arliss, how does it work? Not this is an M5 bolt or whatever. Unless, with the exception of, it doesn't work if this is not an M5. That's a functional, that's part of the concept then. Okay, so let's spend a few minutes introducing the next MicroPython stuff. We'll get you started on some in-class examples, and then we'll start handing out the final kit stuff. So as a reminder, all the code we cover, including the in-class examples, as we do them, is getting added to our GitHub repository. This is at this link, and also a link from the class webpage. Seem to have gotten this, but just a quick review. Remember that the kind of inside part of your breadboard is connected by row, which, however, rotate is actually by column here, as it's drawn. Right? So all of those guys are connected. And remember there is a break in the middle. Kind of a common mistake, right? So they're connected like this, right? A to E is connected, F to J is connected in each one of those rows. Okay. Along the outside, the entire column, if they're oriented the right way, is connected. So all the ones on this side are connected, all the reds are connected. As it's drawn here, the top and bottom are not connected. Okay. So those are two separate buses you can use. Okay. In your kit, we talked about these sensors. And basically, all the analog sensors you have as part of your kit effectively act like variable resistors. Right? They're all analog sensors. We're going to use that ADC to read all of them. Right? And we're going to use a voltage divider to read that change in resistance. Okay. So as the resistance of a sensor changes, right, the ratio of that sensor to a fixed resistance changes the value of this node, the voltage of that at that node, which is what we read. Okay. So by reading the voltage of that node and knowing the value of the fixed resistor, we can know the value that this, of the resistance of the sensor and therefore know kind of what it's sensing. All right. On the Pi board, there are pins dedicated to analog inputs. Right. We're going to prefer these shielded ADC down here. And pretty much always use this shielded power supply, filter power supply. Okay, sensors that don't tend to be so noisy, like the potentiometer, for example, we'll use the other ADC. So we can use any of those ones that are labeled ADC and set them up as a pin. Yes, sir?
It doesn't matter which micro USB cable you use to connect this thing, right? It doesn't have to be the one it came with.
So the question was, when I'm connecting a micro USB cable to this guy, it doesn't really matter. Just make sure that you don't get there are cables around that are just charging, no data. You have to have the data pin, the data cables, the cable, data conductors too. Yep. Okay. So ADC, we had in-class exercise 4 last time. Who worked on this one? Outside of class, a few more of you. Good. So we have when an external push button is pressed, we're going to turn on an LED. Okay. When it's not pressed, the LED should turn off. Same LED, on or off. So when we push it, it turns on. Let off, it goes off. Okay. So the setup for that, I chose to use the red LED and connecting my push button to X6, which is how it's drawn in the figure from that lecture. The GitHub file of this, GitHub page of this also has that drawing in line. So you can see how it's wired up to run this code. Okay. And basically we're defining the LED and defining what pin is the input. And then we loop on that. We're going to set up a loop that runs forever. At the beginning of each time through the loop, it's going to read the value, the current state of that pin, which is a dot value method on that instant of the pin. What does that dot value method return if the button is pressed? Or somebody say it. True. It's going to return a true. True or one, which are equivalent, actually. Okay. So if the button is pressed, how we have it wired, the button, you can wire a button opposite way, but how we have it wired, if we press it, it reads true or high. Okay. True or one. So we have a Boolean that's returned to us, right? So we can use that directly as the conditional of our if statement. So if the button is pressed, this part we know is true, right? What's been stored in there? As we read it. So then what's indented under is going to read, going to run. So I print out that the button's high, and we turn the LED on. Okay. If the button's not pressed, we end up, the dot value method passes back false to us, or zero. Okay. So that means that that part's false, I automatically bounce down to the if, the else. So then I turn the LED off. And we loop on this, and you probably could even do this at 10 milliseconds, no problem. You loop on that fast enough and it reacts, there's not a delay from when you're pressing the button, effectively. It flashes on and off. It's running fast enough where it looks instantaneous to you. And this just runs forever, right? So if this is running forever on my board and I want to get out to the REPL, what do I need to do? Control C. You need to break what's running there. Right, so if you ever log into your, you ever connect to the REPL and you don't see the prompt, the three greater than signs, that's one of the first things to try. Probably first try hitting enter. If that doesn't get you to a prompt, control C to break out, you probably have a script like this that's running on your Pi board. Okay, and you need to break it. Because it won't bounce to the REPL until it's finished with main.py. And if this is in main.py, it never finishes unless you break it. Questions about that one? Okay. In class, exercise 5 was to divide the flex range sensor, the flex sensor range into 4 regions. Okay. And then turn on the same number of LEDs as what region of flex you're in. Okay. So basically, when it's straight, we don't want any LEDs on. When it starts bending, you turn on one LED. When it bends a little further, you want 2, then 3, then 4. So the LEDs on your board are kind of an indicator of how far the flex sensor is built, bent, in other words. Okay. So to set that up, what do I need to do in the software? What's the kind of setup part of that script look like? Yeah, I have to define all my LEDs. Right? I probably need to import PYB in time, which kind of all of our scripts do that. What else do I need to set up? Yeah, the analog to digital conversion for the flex sensor. Okay. So that looks like this. If you match the drawing from the notes, and then as part of the GitHub, in the GitHub folder for this guy, we have the flex sensor plugged into pin X22. Okay, and then we define those 4 LEDs to let us kind of know what's happening better than just typing out PYB every time. So there we go. And I get to this point, and I've tried to stress, to separate out designing your algorithm from actually writing the code. Right? Thinking about what needs to happen is different than figuring out what the syntax needs to be to make that happen. Okay? So when I was doing this, it's a little sloppy, but here are my notes from figuring out how I need to divide that range up and how the math looks. And I know you can't read it right now, but I want to show you that I do this when I'm writing code. Okay, and separate out, and I'm going to encourage you to do the same. Separate out, and it's a piece of scratch paper is often enough to explicitly write out what you want to happen, what the math might need to be to make it happen. Okay? If you're trying to figure out the algorithm as you're writing the code, the best you're going to do is write really inefficient code because you haven't thought clearly enough about what you want to happen to write clear and efficient code. Okay? So separate those steps out. Figure out what your algorithm needs to be and then write the code to do it. Okay? You can't explain your algorithm in just plain English to somebody. So when you're working on stuff with your team, that's a good way to debug what's happening, is force your teammates and you explain what you want to happen in just plain English. Step by step, though, explicitly. If this happens, then I want to do that. Else, if happens that while this sensor is reading this, I want this thing to happen. Explain it just in plain English. You can't do that, you're not going to be able to write code to do it. Okay. So I took this and I know, okay, I need divisions. And I could bend it either way, so I want four divisions on either side of being bent, actually. So set up the math, figure out what the math would be to do that. And this ends up being, there are way more efficient ways to do this, but basically I'm looking at combined if statements. Right, so I'm looking at, if I'm greater than this and less than that, if statements. This code is on GitHub for you to review. And again, there are somewhat more efficient ways to do this, but this is an obvious, straightforward way. And I include this first one to point out to you that the conditionals for your if, conditionals for the while, conditionals anywhere there's a conditional that shows up, you can do combinations. Right? So you can do and or, and exclusive or, those kind of things in those conditionals. Kind of those standard logic, Boolean logic operations work there. I can't see all the code, but questions at a high level about that one.
Can you flash back just one more slide?
Got it? Okay. We had an in-class exercise 6 where you attached that force-sensitive resistor and wanted, as you squeeze that force-sensitive resistor, remember it changes resistance based on how hard you're squeezing it. You want the blue LED to get brighter, like an amusement park strength tester thing, more or less. Right? So what do I need to do to set that one up? The kind of setup part of that script looks like what? Before that, the setup part. Pretty similar, right? I have the LED that I need to define. I need to find the ADC. Right? So the way we have it drawn and configured and what you've seen so far, we plug the ADC into Y12. So we need to find that one. So far, we've called all of these things ADC. But if you're reading more than one sensor, they can't all be named ADC. Right? Because each one defines a unique pin. Right? So we can do FSR ADC. And then instead of just ADC.re, we need FSR underscore ADC.re. Okay, so that's how we're going to do multiple analog sensors. You need this object, you need this instance of the ADC object for every one of those sensors. And then read them independently. Okay? And then, of course, we said we need to figure out what the actual algorithm is before we start. We'll talk a little bit more about algorithms on either Tuesday or Thursday next week. Some really simple ones that can help you with your sensor processing even in this class. Okay. So if I'm going to do this, I have a range in my analog to digital converter between what and what? 0 and 4095, right? Good. Okay. That if I need to vary the intensity of the LED, what does it have to vary between? Well, back up a step. What's the range of that intensity value? What can it be? 0 to 255. So what you need to do, what we need to do then, right, we have a linear, the ADC is between 0 and 495. The LDD dot intensity method takes 0 to 255. So we need to find some kind of function and some kind of math, right, that maps some range of ADC to that, map 0 to 495 to 0 to 255. So that when I'm squeezing as hard as I absolutely can, the value is 4,092, right? The LED is really bright. It's at 254 or whatever. So you need that mapping. What's a good first approximation of what that mapping should probably be? Yeah, it's just you got 2 points. You have a, how do I connect 2 points? Usually a line is a pretty good way to start, right? So map a linear relationship between the two. When it's 0, I want it 0. When it's 495, I want it 255. Solve y equals mx plus b for that. And now you have a mathematical expression. Given an ADC reading, this is what the brightness should be, the intensity. And then you just pass that to the LED. Okay. One thing about this, this is a very good place to start. And it's the first place you probably should start. If you want to get fancy, that's not how our eyes process light. We're not linearly sensitive to different intensities of light. So if you wanted to map that out, there's actually an article linked in the GitHub GitHub script of this that would point you to how you actually need to do that map to make it look linearly in brightness to us. But based on whatever mapping you choose, that's how you set the LED intensity. And that script ends up being a little bit long because it's got the math and everything in it. Too long to show on the slide, but it's linked there. If you haven't taken a look at it, please do. If you haven't been doing these exercises outside of class when we get done, please do. Okay. Like we talked before, you're not going to learn it, you're not going to get it, unless you're spending at least a little bit of time on it. Okay. All right. Questions about kind of review of what we did last time, those examples. The pattern for reading all those analog sensors is basically the same. You set up the ADC instance on the whatever pin number, and then it's whatever you call that ADC instance dot read gives you the value back. And then you can do whatever you want with the value. Okay. In your kit, there's this little hobby style servo motor. And go ahead and dig that out if you like. Should be in a baggie. Inside that baggie also should be a bunch of plastic pieces that are actually attached to the kind of output shaft of that servo. Those are called servo horns. And that's what you can really attach stuff to, really, to make things happen. Okay. If we crack open this servo motor, okay, so this is basically a bigger version of the one you have, and actually a kind of a cheaper one in many ways, but one size larger in terms of the common sizes you see these things. If we crack it open, we'll see it actually has a gear train. The ones you have are actually metal gear. Okay? And we can crack it open a little bit further. And you see inside of these hobby servo motors, there is a small DC motor. Okay? And there's actually some small electronics and quite often a cheap microcontroller inside. In addition, this servo, these hobby-style servo motors, have inside them a potentiometer that is attached to the output shaft. So just like we talked about using the potentiometer that you have in your kit to measure the angle of something, the servo is, these servo motors are doing that internally. Okay. So basically what our control of these servos is going to shake out to be is we're going to say, hey, servo, move to 45 degrees. The internal microcontroller on that servo is going to know where it's at right now. Hey, my current angle is 37 degrees based on what I read from my potentiometer. So I better turn my motor a certain number of times to get me to 45. So this has, we're talking about control, this has a closed loop control on position internally. You don't see that at all. It handles it all for you. So my control of these is going to be go to an angle. Okay. And the servo motor, the microcontroller, the control inside of this board handles getting to that angle. Okay. A few notes about these before we continue. The servo motors you have are not high torque servos. They're not high precision servos, right? They're $12. Servos of that size can be $100 to $200 if you get kind of really professional quality ones. Okay. What that means is you can't hang a big long arm off the end of one of these servos and expect it to work. Okay. It's going to be good for positioning small things, right? It's going to be good for something like pulling a pin out of something, right? Not high torque applications. They also don't do great if they're under a lot of load just sitting there. Okay? They also don't do great if I have a load, rotation axis is this way, out that side. Right? Because basically that ends up affecting this potentiometer, how it gets read. It can mess the servo up. Okay? We're going to talk in just a second about the limits of where this thing can rotate to. Right, these are not continuous rotation servos. They have a range. And these hobby servos, if you slam them against their hard stops by not paying attention to what their actual range is, it's a good chance you're going to damage it, and it's not going to work right after that. Okay, so we're going to talk about the limits where these work well, and we'll talk about the hardware limits. And generally, they work well quite a bit of ways from hitting the hardware limits. Okay, with me so far? There are four pins on the PI board that are specifically set up to control these hobby-style servos. And that's these guys, X1 to X4. And you notice your hobby-level servo has these three wires. They can connect right there if you have the right type of connection. Okay. And you could do something like this, for example. So in this case, we're running all the wires over to our board and then connecting the servo through the breadboard. You could plug them in directly if you really wanted to. Okay. So we need this 5-volt power. It's actually going to come from your USB as we're doing it right now. Okay. We have ground coming over here. Remember, these are all internally connected to the ground of the servo. Okay. And then we have a signal wire that's connected to X1 in this case, which comes over to the signal wire on the servo. I think your servos, you guys are brown, red, orange. Okay, so black is brown is black, orange is yellow. Okay, so you'll see there's kind of two styles of wiring for these servos, the orange one, and then either black, red, yellow, or black, red, white, you'll see as well. Okay. So get that wired up real quick. No, you should have. So the clip. The question was, hey, that clip, does it come off? Well, you have male-to-male wires, so you can run male side from your breadboard into the female side of that wire. Or male into your board, male into the female side of the servo too, if you didn't want to go through the breadboard, it's fine. And you probably want to have your PI board unplugged while you're doing this. Remember, that's good practice. Power things down as you're wiring them. Okay, looks like most of us are connected or pretty close to it. Controlling that servo motor is pretty easy, actually. Okay. So like most stuff, and this is what we show here is assuming you've imported PYB and maybe imported time too, depending on what you're trying to do, right? Okay. So those imports are not shown. Right, I can set up an instance of this servo thing And we're going to call it servo 1 because it's plugged into X1, right? And that pyb.servo object is numbered just like you would expect from X1 to X4. Okay? So if you do pyb.servo 1, what you're telling the Pi board is, hey, I have a servo plugged into X1. If you do pyb.servo 2, you're saying, hey, my servo is plugged into X2. Similarly for X3 and X4. And in this case, I'm just calling it servo 1. In your final project code, it might be gripper servo equals pyb.servo 1 if you had the servo controlling some kind of little gripper or something. So that way you can tell exactly by that name what it's controlling. Okay? To tell it to go, to tell it to move, you issue this dot angle method on whatever you call that variable. So for me, that's servo 1. So I can do servo 1.angle 45 and tell it to move to 45 degrees. Okay. Zero is its center position. When you create that instance up top, it's going to go to zero. Okay. From there, you can tell it to move. These servos, all these hobby level servos, most of them, pretty much all of them, are advertised as having plus or minus 90 degrees around that zero of operating range. They do not. Okay. Don't try to go to 90 degrees. You're going to slam against the hard stop. The microcontroller on that servo is going to try to keep getting to 90 degrees, and you're either going to break the servo or burn out the motor driver or do other stuff. You get this strange behavior. Okay? You're better off, generally, for this type of servo, staying plus or minus 45 degrees or maybe even smaller range than that. So keep that in mind. These guys work better around zero than they do around either edge. Okay? So I can tell it to move to 45, right? It doesn't wait. The MicroPython doesn't wait for that servo to get to 45 degrees before it moves on. So remember that. I've just told it, because I can hand off the control of that servo to the servo itself. I say, hey, Ms. Hodge, you go to 45 degrees. And then I'm going to trust her to get to 45 degrees. I'm going to go on and start doing some other stuff. Okay? So if you want the you need something to get to a position before you continue, you need to explicitly add that time into your code. And wait, give it some time to move and get to where you need it to go, if you need it to happen that way. Yes, sir?
So if you didn't have that time, it would start going to 45 and then just
immediately come back to minus 45. That's right. So tell it to go whatever angle you want. Okay. You can get information about angle. It's not the actual physical angle of the servo itself. We don't have any information about that. What this angle thing returns is the last angle you told it to go to, or the angle you're currently telling it to go to, in other words. Okay. So in this case, this guy would return minus 45, because that was the last one I told it to go to. And again, that's not a measurement of the output. That's a kind of measurement of what I asked it to do last. So if everything's working really well, it might be where it's at, but not necessarily. Okay. I also could tell it to go to some angle over some duration. Okay. So if I include not just the angle, but some secondary number, and this secondary number is the time to move between where I am now and that angle in milliseconds. So in this case, my servo may have been at minus 45. I'm saying move from minus 45, my current position, to 45 degrees, and take 2,000 milliseconds to do that. Okay, 2 seconds to make that move. So this is one way you can control the speed at which your servos move, this parameter here, by timing it effectively. So give moving the servos a shout out. You could do this straight from the REPL if you want, right? So if you control C into the REPL and you get the REPL prompt, you can define your servo object and then start telling it to move the angles by just typing it in directly. Okay. Seems like most folks had servos moving. Okay. We need to make some progress. Hold on a sec. If you have questions, just hold on to them for right now. OK. Okay, so that's how we can pre-program a directory. Say, for example, you are testing your robot and you don't know quite what angle you want your servo to go to. Okay. So, of course, you could program, hard code that into the REPL every time, right? Or hard code that in the main every time and rerun it. Okay. Simpler way might be to do something like this. We can ask the user for input through the REPL while main is running. All right, heads up here, guys. You can go back to your scripts in a second. Okay? So we can ask the user for input while the main.py is running. Okay, and wait for them to return some input. And conveniently, the function that we call for that is called input. Okay? So basically, we can do something like this. Right? We can print something out to the REPL and ask the user, hey, give me an angle that you want to move this servo to. And it'll sit there and wait until they type in something and press return. Okay? And the way to do that is just give this input. This is the function name with no argument in parentheses. And it will just sit there forever and ever and ever, wait for someone to type something in and press enter. Okay? Whatever they type in gets saved into desired angle input as a variable. Right? That's what gets stored into that variable. Okay. What problems do you see with this? May not be the most accurate judge of an angle you want to go for, but just in general, like maybe, you know, I gave the example of tuning your robotic arm, but just accepting input from a user like this. They don't know the hardware limits. What else? Well, you would run this kind of once per angle if you're doing it that way. Well, this can be part of your main file, is what I'm saying. Right? This is in your main before you move the arm to whatever angle. How do you know what angle it is at? There's even a bigger issue here. If you're handing this over to a random user, they need to know the format, how to input angle. Now you're getting closer. You're getting warmer. Is someone always going to input a number? No. Right? So they could input hello, right, there. And hello as a string gets stored into desired angle input. And then you can tell the server to go to hello. And actually some weird stuff will happen. You actually won't even get an error for that. Some weird stuff will happen. Okay? So basically, you don't have any input, any guarantee that your user is going to input a reasonable number or a number at all. Okay, so we are responsible for checking to make sure that is a valid number we get before we issue it to the servo. Or you could do motor speed, similar to this, right? Ask the user for a motor speed they want to run the motor at, they enter it, and away you go. Right? But you have to explicitly check that. So one thing we're going to do, and we're going to talk way more about this try except formulation, is we're going to try to take that desired angle input that we got from our user that they entered in the last slide, and we're going to try to convert that to an integer. Right? To do that, we just do int, and then whatever the variable we're trying to convert to an integer inside parentheses. Okay? So if they gave us 42, 42 would be there. An integer value of 42 is just 42. We're good to go. Okay. If they gave us hello, okay, it's going to try to say, I want the integer value, integer version of hello. Well, Python's smart enough to say, hey, I can't do that. Hello doesn't have an integer equivalent. Okay. So what it's going to raise in this case is an error. It's a particular type of error called a value error. So what this try except formulation is doing for us, try to convert it to an integer stored in this value. Okay? If you get an error when you do that, and in particular if you get a value error when you do that, do this stuff instead. Okay. So we're going to try to convert it to an integer. If I can't do that, it comes down here and says, well, if the error I got is a value error, then I'm going to do this stuff instead. Okay? And what we do is prompt the user again. Hey, that's not a valid user angle. I'm just going to stay where I'm at. And we tell the user what's going on. Okay? This try except, we're going to use a lot when we're controlling hardware. One second. Okay? When you're writing code, we need to wrap anything that's moving hardware in this kind of formulation. Right? A lot of what we're going to do is tell a motor to run. Go run at half speed. Right? And the way our kit is set up, that motor will run at half speed is forever, as long as it's got power to do so, until we tell it something different. Okay? So if something goes wrong in your code and you get some kind of error, that motor doesn't know about that, actually. So we can do this same formulation to when we get an exception to turn a motor off. And again, we'll talk in way more detail about that next week. Okay? But this is our first hint at that. We can try to do stuff, right? And if error happens, do something else. This is a formalized method in pure Python too, not just MicroPython. Okay. It's called catching exceptions. Yes, sir?
So in this case, the user would be other like inputs from sensors?
No, this is a user through the REPL, through the serial interface. Okay. You're not going to see REPL prompt. We'll run this in a second. You can see. So the question, can I use this to kind of process sensor values? You don't generally want to do a try except for that. Okay. The try except catches syntax errors, catches kind of processing errors of Python. Like I'm trying to convert a string into an integer. I'm trying to divide by zero. I can't do that. Right? So it can catch those type of things. Right? If you're waiting for a sensor to be a certain reading, you probably want to do one of the other conditionals we've already learned to do that. Okay. So this tells us that if I, you know, basically, I've either converted what my user gave me to the desired angle as an integer, or I'm not going to change it at all. I'm just going to use this current angle that I issued maybe last time. Okay. So I have an angle saved. We still have some problems, though. What problems do we have? Even after we do this. They didn't print, yeah, maybe. Not yet. I mean, we haven't shown that. There's something, I think, I heard somebody say it, I think. Yeah, I haven't checked to actually the integer I got in the range of acceptable values yet. All this told me was, hey, the user gave me a number, basically. So they could have given me 1,337,417. We can't go to that angle. Right? So you still need to check that. And I think this is closer to what you're asking about. So if you check, I need to make sure what the angle I got out, even if it is an integer, I need to make sure it's within the range of limits that I can actually move to. Right? So in this case, what I've done is that if the desired angle is greater than my servo max angle, which I've defined somewhere else in the code, set it to the servo max, move to the maximum, instead of moving to the desired 1 million whatever. Okay. If it's less than the servo minimum angle, right, move to the minimum instead of moving to whatever 1,000 degrees they told us to go to, minus 1,000. Okay. Otherwise, if it, you know, it makes it do both of those, it's an acceptable value, move to the angle they asked for. Okay. So you can do this on servo angle. You can do this on motor speed. Right. But we need to do this. When we're taking input from the user, quite often we need to do this as part of our own algorithms. Right? I might have some control algorithm that's calculating motor speed. Before I issue that motor speed to the motor, I better make sure it's within the limits of the motor too, still. Okay? Okay, so I'm going to flash up an in-class exercise. I want you guys to start working on that. It's going to be using a potentiometer and a servo. Okay. Once we get set up starting into that, what we're going to do is bring teams up to the front with us to see the components of your kit and check them out, and we'll have a form for you to sign. Okay. Before we start on the in-class exercise, let's talk about that form. Form looks like this. We'll get it and we'll be here and fill it out with you. You're going to put your team number at the top on this leftmost column. There are two lines. The column title is received. One of your teammates needs to initial that you received that component. One of us will initial saying, yes, we gave you that component. Okay. So once you've initialed saying, I got everything, all three of you need to sign at the bottom saying that, yes, we got everything that's initialed here. Okay. This is our contract to make sure we get our kits back at the end of the term. If you initial off that you got it from us, we have to get it back at the end of the semester. If we don't get it back at the end of the semester, you have an incomplete until we do get it back. Okay? So we'll hang on to these forms. When we get ready to return the kits, we'll check off just like we're doing today, but in kind of reverse. Okay? That clear? Okay. So our in-class exercise. You need to attach a potentiometer. Probably that little blue trim pot we had is the easiest one. Okay? And what you want to do is your servo output to track the angle of the potentiometer. Heads up while I'm explaining. You might want to wait until you understand the problem. It's kind of one of the main points of this class, right? Okay? So attach the potentiometer. So when the potentiometer, there's a little arrow on that blue trim pot. If it's straightforward, you want your servo at 0 degrees. Move it to one side, you want the servo to move one direction. As you move it to the other, you want the servo to move the other direction. All right? So that's an in-class exercise we're working on while we're handing out kits. Depending on how quick the kits go, we might come back together. All right?